Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you all for joining us. Today's call is on the record, and the audio file will be available on our website, cfr.org, if you would like to share it with colleagues or classmates. We are delighted to have Seth Jones with us today to discuss Afghanistan after the drawdown. Seth Jones is the Associate Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND Corporation. He is also an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University School for Advanced International Studies. And previously, he served as representative for the commander to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and as advisor to the commanding general in Afghanistan. He specializes in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism with a focus on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Al-Qaeda, and is author of Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda After 9/11, and In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. He recently authored a CFR special report on Afghanistan. Dr. Jones, thanks very much for being with us today. It would be terrific if you could give us an overview of the elections that we just saw happening over the during the weekend, as well as what you see as the residual forces necessary in Afghanistan beyond 2014.
Thanks, Irina, and thanks to everybody for participating online. As Irina mentioned, I'll start off with some comments, and then we'll turn this over to the question and answer segment. But let me just begin by highlighting the last presidential elections that we had in the United States, which occurred in November of 2012, where U.S. voter turnout was about 58%. On Saturday in Afghanistan, we had elections, presidential elections, where turnout was about the same. Yet in that case, Afghans voting in many places of the country faced dire threats, violence, indications that their fingers would be cut off if they voted. So striking, as you think about it, whether we in the United States would have put up with that level of risk for voting for our presidential candidate. So the issue, I think, that I wanted to throw out on the table is we have just gone through, in the process of going through an important democratic transition in a country that about 13 or 14 years ago was an authoritarian regime where women could not vote, women couldn't work in general, and where gross human rights abuses by the Taliban were at extraordinary levels. So the election now, we had minimal violence, again, high voter turnout. There are some indications of potential corruption, fraud, and ballot box stuffing, which occurred in 2009 and occurred in the previous election. So there are some issues. But more broadly, I mean, I think this was an important step forward for the country. And as everybody on the call is aware, one of the key defining periods for Afghanistan was on September 11th, when Al-Qaeda, which was based out of Afghanistan, plotted and then oversaw the attacks in New York City, in Washington, D.C., and then the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. So the question that I want to deal with in the next couple of minutes is what are we dealing with in Afghanistan? What does this mean for us back here in the United States? What the U.S. has committed to right now is to withdraw and end its combat mission largely by the end of this year, 2014. It is still unclear, and the U.S. president has not made a final decision on what the U.S. force presence will look like, or how much assistance may be provided to the Afghan government as population. But I wanted to highlight, as we start getting into this, what and why Americans should care And I think the U.S. has several interests still in Afghanistan. The first one is that Al-Qaeda, that organization that targeted the United States in 2011, its leadership, what is often called the core Al-Qaeda, is still located in this region, though it has been weakened somewhat by persistent U.S. strikes and operations. The concern, though, is a civil war or a successful Taliban-led insurgency would almost certainly allow these kinds of groups to increase their presence in Afghanistan. We've already seen it in northeastern parts of the country, a spreading of some Al-Qaeda training camps just along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. Second, a burgeoning war in Afghanistan, if the U.S. were to leave, could potentially increase regional instability as India, Pakistan, Iran, Russia, and potentially China, all of which have nuclear weapons or, in the case of Iran, developing nuclear weapons. These countries have in the past, are today, and will likely continue to support a range of government forces, sub-state forces, and insurgent groups. Happy to unpack that in more detail. The concern is that a precipitous U.S. withdrawal from this area could cause regional problems among a number of major governments in the region. And then finally, a U.S. military departure, if it were to happen precipitously, could foster a perception, however misplaced, that the U.S. is not a reliable ally. Al-Qaeda and associated groups have already argued right now that the withdrawal of U.S. forces is their most important victory since the departure of Soviet forces from Afghanistan in 1989. I realize that there are a range of public opinion polls where Americans have questioned the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. I would highlight, though, that the U.S. presence has significantly decreased, and the Afghan government is far and away involved in the vast majority of its counterinsurgency efforts. It's Afghans now that are fighting and, sadly, in some cases, dying for their country. But that's the way it should be. That's the way the United States obviously fought its Revolutionary War against the British. It was American patriots that fought and died for their country. As we move forward, I will highlight a couple of things that I think are important in U.S. policy towards Afghanistan. The first one, the one that we see with the elections, is the importance of not just focusing on who gets elected. There are three individuals right now, Rasool, Ashraf Ghani, and Dr. Abdullah, who are likely candidates for the next president. They're the ones right now which it looks like have the highest levels of voter support, although we won't find out until later this month what the final vote tallies are. What's probably less important is that individual himself and more the ability to reach out and bring in a number of different ethnic groups into multi-ethnic coalitions. Afghanistan, as many of you know, includes a patchwork of Uzbek ethnic groups, Tajiks, Hazaras, Pashtuns. And so the issue, because we look forward, is how can we support all of these different ethnic groups supporting an Afghan nation, and that means putting them into key positions within the government, supporting key constituencies. So one issue here is to continue to support the Afghan nation as opposed to the fracturing possibilities that we've seen in Afghanistan's past, including in the 1990s. The second issue is that I strongly support a continuing United States mission that primarily focuses on providing security assistance, that is, training, advising, and assisting Afghan forces, and then some ability to strike terrorists on Afghan soil if there is evidence that they're plotting attacks against the United States or against U.S. structures like embassies overseas. I've assessed a requirement for about 8,000 to 12,000 American forces. Just to be clear, what we're arguing is the bulk of the combat against the Taliban and other insurgent groups should be done and is being done by the Afghan government. But the U.S. can provide some background assistance, as it's done in the Philippines, in Colombia, and in multiple other countries overseas, and continues to do in many of these countries today. In addition, we do support Afghan-led discussions with the Taliban on a peace deal, and strongly agree that peace is going to happen in one of two ways, and it's happened in one of two ways in wars like what we see in Afghanistan. Either it ends with a peace deal and a settlement, as we saw, say, in El Salvador in the early 1990s, or it happens because one side or another wins on the battlefield. It's not entirely clear which of those options is going to end the war in Afghanistan, which has essentially lasted in various fits since the mid and late 1970s. But I think continuing to support a peace deal, if it's possible, is an important one. And then lastly, let me just say that there is a need, I think, to continue for the United States and a range of other countries, including its allies in Europe, in Asia, including Japan, to support civilians within Afghanistan. Some of the areas that have been most helpful to Afghan citizens have been education programs and public health programs. The irony, as we look at Afghanistan in April of 2014, we think back to 2001 when the World Trade Center came crashing down in New York City, the Pentagon was struck in Washington, and the airplane went down in Pennsylvania, is that at that point, Afghanistan was a repressive, was in a repressive, in the throes of a repressive regime, and it's come a long way since then. Incomes have gone up dramatically. Afghans, as I highlighted earlier, are allowed to vote and have voted at levels that are comparable with the United States, but with extraordinary levels of violence. Health conditions have dramatically improved. Education levels, including with women, have also significantly increased. There are challenges. There is a war that is still going on. There are concerns about corruption and about the quality of governance. But I would say across the board, Afghan society, and we see this in opinion polls, Afghan society is much better off than it was before the United States got involved in 2001. So in closing, let me just say that that the United States and other countries involved in Afghanistan have done a tremendous job over the past 13 years. Sure, they've made mistakes in some categories, but Afghans in general are in a much better position than they were 13 years ago. If the U.S. were to leave precipitously, including withdraw all of its forces, what is being called the zero option, by the end of this year, though, many of these things could certainly be that there could be extreme risk to continuing this progress. So I think it is in the U.S.'s interest and in America's interest to continue to make sure that Afghans, including its people, remain prosperous and free, and that the amount of money that it's going to take to do that is actually quite small. So I'll turn it now over to Irina, and I'm sure there are a lot of questions on elections, U.S. interests, and a range of other things. Thanks for listening.
Wonderful. Thanks, Seth. That was a great overview and analysis. Lindsay, let's open up to the students for questions.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Our first question comes from the University of California in Los Angeles.
Hi, I'm Jason, a student at UCLA. I have a question about the Afghan National Army and the police. In the past year, as they stepped up their involvement, they've taken a lot of casualties, and I'm wondering how this has affected those forces' cohesion and problems with attrition, which have been serious problems with sustaining Afghan security forces in the past.
Jason, that's a great question. The bulk of Afghan security forces are, as you note, army and police. There are also some local security forces and intelligence forces as well. The army and especially the police, as you note, have taken a number of casualties. Levels have gone up. They've been hit with roadside bombs, targeted assassinations. I think what's surprising, though, is in a number of key provinces like Kandahar. Kandahar is, what I would assess, probably the most important or one of the most important strategic provinces for the Taliban. It's where they had their inner shura in the 1990s when they ruled the country. Kandahar, despite these levels of violence, the Afghan government and its local allies have remained in control of most of the key districts within the province. So, in my view, the threat levels and the targeting of the forces does not appear likely to wear down either the army or the police. There are some concerns in a few other areas. I think if the election process gets messy at some point in the foreseeable future, or the U.S. decides to pull out all of its forces, those two things do have the possibility, I think, of causing some concerns within the Afghan National Security Force apparatus, including and probably especially with the army. And that would, you'd start to see that. We see that a little bit right now with people hedging with visa applications for security forces, people wanting to bring at least their families and potentially maybe themselves to places like Europe or, in some cases, the United States or India or other locations. So the short, then, summary in response to your question is I think the Army and the police in particular have done a pretty good job of holding ground in some areas despite high levels of violence. And, again, if they're going to run into trouble at some point, in my view, that those are probably not the issues that are going to cause them to fracture. It's going to be other probably political issues or ones of the U.S. Pullout.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the Havard School.
Good afternoon. Our question is, given the problems that al-Qaeda caused for the Taliban with their attack on the United States in September of 2001, why do you think the Taliban would continue to harbor al-Qaeda should they return to power in Afghanistan?
That's a great question. One would think logically that the harboring of al-Qaeda militants, including Osama bin Laden in 2001, which in part led to the overthrow of the Taliban regime, one would think that that would cause the Taliban to rethink its harboring of al-Qaeda terrorists in Afghanistan today. But actually, 2 points along those lines. One is, just to be clear about this, there have been a number of discussions within the Taliban's inner shura, that is their primary decision-making body, which sits actually on the Pakistan side of the border, about the relationship with al-Qaeda. The way I kind of characterize it is they're generally okay with an al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan as long as it's not overt, meaning as long as al-Qaeda leaders don't publicly acknowledge that they're in Afghanistan. And I think there is some concern among some senior Taliban leaders about having the al-Qaeda leadership, that is, you know, today that would be Ayman al-Zawahiri or other top officials in Afghanistan. I think they'd prefer to see them on the Pakistan side. But the issue to see it from the Taliban side right now is they perceive the situation right now that they're on balance winning, and that with the U.S., in their view, likely to leave sooner rather than later, their prospects are going to improve. So from their standpoint, I think, you know, they are looking at gaining support from a number of militant groups, which they get from Central Asia, groups like the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, groups from Pakistan, and then al-Qaeda has been has played an important role in providing improvised explosive devices. They provided some fighters on the ground, so they're playing a helpful role from the Taliban's perspective as long as they minimize external plotting from Afghan soil. So the mindset from the Taliban generally is things are going in their direction or are likely going to go in their direction, and al-Qaeda can play a helpful role in some areas as long as they stay within a box. It's a very serious risk and a very serious game that they're playing. But where we see al-Qaeda present in places like northeastern Afghanistan, they have Taliban commanders directly supporting them in provinces like Kunar. So, again, it's a very dangerous gamble, and I think one in the long run the Taliban are going to lose. But it's a great question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question. Thank you. Our next question comes from Texas Women's University.
Good morning, Seth. Good afternoon there. Just wanted to get your views on the prospects for Afghanistan going forward. That would be, say, after the drawdown. What are your thoughts on prospects for Afghanistan going forward?
Well, Michael, I think the issue, I'll try and bin that into several categories. One is on the security situation. I think the two biggest variables in play, actually three biggest variables in play, are one is what will be the U.S. and broader international role, both in providing minimal training, advising, and assistance to the Afghan security forces, but also funding to Afghan ministries. One may remember that 1989 was the last year that the Soviet Union had combat forces in Afghanistan. They withdrew up into the Soviet Union. Yet, in various forms, regimes continued to survive until 1996 when the Taliban was overthrown. And probably the biggest concern in Afghanistan at that point, especially by 1992, was Soviet funding was cut off at that point. So if we take some historical examples here, if the U.S. and some of the international community can continue to provide assistance and continue to provide limited training, advising, and assisting to the government, I think the government is likely to be able to hang on. It won't control all areas of the country, but it will not likely be overthrown by insurgent groups. That's kind of the security situation. But that does hinge on an international presence. It also hinges on these elections, particularly if they go to a second round. It hinges on the elections being widely or at least roughly accepted by Afghanistan's major constituencies. On the economic side, I think the growth, the GDP data will probably decrease somewhat just because of the sheer amount of financial assistance coming into Afghanistan will and already has declined. So what we'll probably see is low levels of GDP growth, 2, 3, 4%, but in the positive side, just not the high levels we've seen over the last several years because of the massive infusion of international capital. And I think if there are still a range of non-governmental organizations that continue in Afghanistan, we'll see those health figures and education figures continue to improve somewhat with literacy rates getting better and general life expectancy, infant mortality rates improving. If the U.S. does pull out or stops its funding, I change that answer potentially considerably. So part of that kind of hinges on what the international community's will. The other issue, obviously, is what the neighbors do. So that question may come up a little bit later, but you know, part of the future of the country does hinge on what Iran, Russia, Pakistan, and a number of others do. Good question. Very difficult to answer in 4 to 5 minutes, but I try to lay it out in a few key areas. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star one now. Our next question comes from Miami-Dade College.
Hi, my name is Miguel, and my question is, you guys have established this great infrastructure within the society, but if all the U.S. troops would leave, and suppose this infrastructure would be damaged either politically or economically, have you guys implemented preventive steps for the society to kind of repair itself? I mean,
and one more question, please. Do you believe that the U.S. has accomplished all the goals that they set out for themselves when they headed out over there also?
Thank you.
Good questions. First one from Miguel. If the all the U.S. troops depart, if I understand the question correctly, is sufficient infrastructure and other things in place for the country to continue to survive or at least move forward? You know, the answer there is it's unclear right now. There's been a lot of funding to improve basic governance in the country. There's been funding to build infrastructure. If the U.S. were to leave, the answer would then hinge entirely on the Afghan government, its ability to then continue to deliver basic services to its population and provide and protect its citizens through law enforcement, policing, and other actions. The big variable, frankly, is the Afghan state in general and historically has been somewhat weak. So this has provided an opportunity for neighboring states to become engaged in Afghanistan. My concern is that a departure of the U.S. and a number of its other international allies, including the British, the United Nations, and a range of other countries, what it may do is increase the Pakistan presence in Afghanistan, the Iranian presence in Afghanistan, the Russian presence in Afghanistan, the Indian presence in Afghanistan, so that there is competition and funding going to multiple different actors. And the concern there is that the state at that point and its ability to do everything, Miguel, that you were suggesting, the state's ability to do that begins to break down. A lot of funding goes to sub-state actors, militia forces, power brokers, local commanders. That's a little bit of the history of the early 1990s after the Soviets departed and after Soviet funding stopped and then Russian funding stopped. So one concern here is whether there's a somewhat of a vacuum because the Afghan state has historically had limitations, especially in rural areas, and whether it's then filled by Afghanistan's powerful neighbors. And that is a bit of a concern, I think, going forward, if there's a precipitous thought. And then the other question on U.S., whether the U.S. has accomplished its goals, I think the answer depends in part on which goals. And there have obviously been a number of, there's been two major U.S. administrations, a number of senior policymakers. One of the goals has certainly been accomplished, and that is Al-Qaeda has been weakened in Afghanistan, and at least by 2001 standards, its base of operations has been pushed across the border into Pakistan. That obviously could change at some point down the road, but we don't see a tremendous amount of external plotting coming from Afghanistan. There does appear to have been, over the last couple of weeks, increase in plotting, but I think some of the U.S.'s goals have been accomplished, though not all.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Pitzer College.
Thank you very much for your presentation. My question is in relation to the ethnic correlation of forces in Afghanistan. That is, the Pashtuns are a majority, and I think they constitute much of the Taliban forces. What would happen let's say, in the future in terms of how these ethnic groups are going to work out relations among them?
That's a very, very interesting question. Let me just summarize briefly the ethnic laydown and then answer the question. There has not been a census in several decades in Afghanistan, so the percentages of ethnic groups are a little unclear, and it is the subject of intense controversy and massive speculation in Afghanistan. But the largest ethnic group does remain the Pashtuns, though it is interesting to note that there are generally more Pashtuns on the Pakistan side of the border as there are on the Afghan side of the border. In addition, in the west of Afghanistan, there are a number of Shia, Hazara, also in central Afghanistan, in a number of provinces like Uruzgan and Dikundi, we see a number of Shia, Hazara. And then up in the north, we see a number of Tajiks, Uzbeks, and other ethnic groups. As you know, the Pashtuns are the Taliban are primarily Pashtun, though it is important to note that most Pashtuns are not Taliban. In fact, one of the things that we see within the Pashtun community is much of the violence actually is intra-Pashtun rather than between Pashtuns and Tajiks, Uzbeks, and others. But there are a couple of things that I wanted to briefly point out. One is that, how the elections go actually can impact this issue significantly. It looks like the two highest vote getters in the election from last Saturday, though the votes haven't been formally announced yet, are probably going to be Ashraf Ghani, who is a Pashtun, and then Abdullah, who is mostly, or at least is half Tajik and is viewed as a northerner. If you were to get an Abdullah victory in Afghanistan, you would probably get a large-scale insurrection among many Pashtuns who will not accept someone they view as a northerner running the country. That is a potential issue. I think it's unlikely, but that is a potential issue. The other thing that I think is a bit of concern along the ethnic lines is if the United States, again, were to withdraw all of its forces, what we've already seen with some of the groups operating in northern Afghanistan, including Tajiks and Uzbeks, is that they've already started to arm their own communities. So we might then at that point see the state begin to weaken as funding got pushed down to local militia commanders, Uzbek, Tajik, Hazara, and other militia commanders. And so in that sense, I think there is an interesting question. If you get a U.S. withdrawal, complete withdrawal from the country, the ethnic issue does become an important one, because at some point down the road, if you're living in the north, you're going to assume that the Taliban are going to try to come back, and then those groups are going to want to arm themselves. So there are a couple of scenarios, I think, where we could see the ethnic dimension rear up, but it's a very important issue to keep track of.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the University of Richmond.
Hi, thank you for your time. I have a question about the future relationship between, say, the USA and the Pakistani ISI. As we know, the relationship has been, plagued with mistrust over the years and has forced the United States to take a more unilateral approach towards bin Laden. So given that and given the current drawdown of U.S. troops in the region, what do you see the relationship looking like in the future?
Well, this has been a very, very tense relationship over the past several years. And just so everybody's aware on the line, the question coming from the University of Richmond was largely about the relationship between the United States and Pakistan, but Pakistan's chief spy agency is the Inter Services Intelligence Directorate, or ISI. The reason this is a challenge is historically what we've seen is, and it's understandable, is Pakistan has a large border on one side with India, in which it's fought several wars and continues to have a troubling relationship with, as India has with Pakistan. And then on its other border, it obviously has a large, over 1,000-mile border with Afghanistan. During the 1990s, Pakistan had an ally in Kabul, Afghanistan's capital, and that was with the Taliban. Today, the Afghan government's strongest regional ally, President Karzai's strongest regional ally, is with India. So from the Pakistan standpoint, it has a poor relationship with India on one border, and on its other border, it's got a pretty poor relationship with an Afghan state that's got what it perceives as close relations with India. This has then caused, in part, the parts of the Pakistan government, including its military and intelligence arm, to provide assistance to sub-state actors, the Taliban and a range of other groups that operate in Afghanistan. The ISI issue is one of concern. If we go back to 2008, there was a massive bombing in July of 2008 at the Indian embassy. And it became clear to U.S. officials at that point that the ISI was involved in that bombing. And President Bush went public, or U.S. administration officials went public with signals intelligence intercepts of ISI officials talking with the perpetrators of the attack in American papers, including a story by Mark Mazzetti and Eric Schmidt in the New York Times, which highlighted the intercepts. One of the interesting things we've seen recently in the last month was very concerning developments. There was a major attack at a five-star hotel in Kabul, which involved Lashkar-e-Taiba. It's a Pakistan group with close ties to the ISI. I would say the big picture moving forward is Pakistan, including its security services, will almost certainly continue to back a number of insurgent groups with the hopes down the road that they'll have an ally that they can work with in Kabul. Now, the danger there, and they realize this, is in Afghanistan that falls into massive anarchy may also provide a safe haven for groups that target the Pakistan state, and that includes groups like the Tariqi Taliban Pakistan or the Pakistan Taliban, which has conducted attacks in Pakistan cities. This is a very dangerous gamble, and one that the U.S. is going to have to monitor pretty closely. But this Pakistan military / ISI relationship with the United States is one that has been a very delicate one over the last several years. There's been a lot of finger pointing from both sides. Very, very from the University of Richmond. Very, very good and very important question, I think, again, as we move forward.
Thank you. Next question. Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star one now. Our next question comes from the University of Houston.
This is Hakeem from the University of Houston. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to ask you some questions. My question is related about the future of Afghanistan and how the United States will approach it. We mentioned that the elections passed and international community and the Afghan people were largely happy with it. The results will be announced in a month or so, and out of the three leading candidates, two of them, either Rasul or Ghani or Abdullah, will become the future leader of Afghanistan. Now, from these two candidates, Rasool and Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai, they have supported peace talks with the Afghan Taliban. And whether the Afghan Taliban will come and participate in the future of Afghanistan, that largely depends on how much the Afghan government and international community is willing to cooperate with them and accept their conditions. So that would be one question. My main question is, what and how should the U.S. government approach Al-Qaeda's presence in Pakistan, because the source of insurgency is mainly in Pakistan, as it's largely understood. And as long as that continues, I think, realistically speaking, there won't be a greater hope for peace in general. So I hope my question was understood. Thank you.
Hakeeb, if I got your name right, from Houston. I'll break it down into two components. The first is on the peace talks. And I would just say, when you look at the conditions for previous peace talks, successful peace talks, there have generally been a few issues that have been important. One is both sides of the conflict generally have to assess their battlefield situations as being a stalemate and likely to stay a stalemate for the foreseeable future. There are generally other kinds of issues that are important. One is a third-party mediator, and there are a number of other conditions that have generally been important for peace talks to actually not just happen, but to stick once there are agreements. The challenge with Afghanistan today, even if we had Ashraf Ghani or Rasool as winning and becoming president, both are Pashtuns, both have been willing to reach out and support peace negotiations with the Taliban. The challenge is going to be, do both the Afghan government side and the Taliban side view the situation right now on the ground, the war on the ground, as a stalemate? And I think the answer right now is, based on most indications from the Taliban side, is they don't believe the situation is at a stalemate right now, or at the very least is not likely to stay that way if international forces leave. So I think that's going to make it difficult. There are some groups like Hizb Islami that the Afghan government has been willing and able to establish some limited peace deals with, but the Taliban are going to be difficult if they continue to believe that they're likely to win in the future. I think that's going to be the biggest sticking point for the Afghan government, especially if Rasool or Ghani wins and the U.S. decides to leave, is to convince the Taliban that their prospects in the future aren't going to get any better. And if the U.S. decides to leave, I just don't see the Taliban coming to that kind of conclusion. On the Pakistan question, I mean, there's no question, at least for me, that the command and control nodes, this is a reality issue, command and control nodes for all the major insurgent groups, the Taliban in particular, but also others like the Haqqani Network, are all on the Pakistan side of the border. Taliban's got its command and control network in Balochistan province. And while I think some people can go too far in claiming that the source of all instability is in Pakistan, I would dispute that a little bit, just because there are a number of Afghans that do fight in this war and have been unhappy with the state of governance in their own country, in Afghanistan. So the sources of instability, in my view, are both within Afghanistan as well as Pakistan. But I've long argued that the insurgency needs to be dealt with effectively in Pakistan itself. That's a very, very difficult situation. And I think when it comes to groups like Al-Qaeda or the Taliban operating in Pakistan, there needs to be a very serious rethinking of U.S. relations with the Pakistan government on putting pressure on a number of these organizations inside of Pakistan territory. But I would argue, as long as they exist, as long as they're operating, and as long as they're essentially allowed to run the insurgency from their areas, whether it's down in Balochistan province or up in the tribal areas, this insurgency in Afghanistan will continue. You know, we've suggested a few steps that can be taken in the Council on Foreign Relations report that Irina mentioned earlier, and I would still highlight some of those as well. But the Pakistan dimension, again, is an important one.
Thanks.
Thank you. Next
Green,
question.
Green, over to you.
Yes, next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the University of California in Los Angeles.
Hi, good morning. My name is Mike. I'm a public policy student here at UCLA. My question is, I believe your assessment was for a range of about 8,000 to 12,000 troops within Afghanistan, you know, following the withdrawal. And, you know, my question is kind of multi-parted or multi-layered, but, you know, one, how did you arrive at that number? Two, what do you envision the residual troops' mission being? I know you mentioned kind of the counterterrorism analogy within the Philippines and Abu Sayyaf. And also, what do you think NATO's responsibility should be, or if NATO should have a presence in that residual force as well?
Good question. So I'll unpack the 8 to 12 a little bit. And we looked at a range of other force packages. And the way we did it, this is not all in the report per se, just because trying to keep the word length of the Council on Foreign Relations report down to readable levels. But we built several force packages sort of from the ground up. So, we looked obviously at a zero option with no forces. We looked at one that was largely a counterterrorism force of 2,000 roughly. And so we based it on roughly two squadrons of task force units, Joint Special Operations Command units, and we built based on existing task force sizing units. So the argument was if we were to just do a counterterrorism mission based on the structures within current task force units, what would that mean in numbers of task force soldiers on the ground plus any of the enablers that they'd need, like helicopters and intelligence surveillance, reconnaissance assets, et cetera. Then we built slightly bigger packages that would add other elements to task force units that would include things like U.S. Army Green Berets, Operational Attachment Alphas that would do training, advising, and assisting, SEAL platoons that could do some of the similar things, Marine Special Operation components, some security force assistance teams, and then any of what you call enablers that go with those packages, like intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance units, including drones. And by drones, I'm really referring predominantly to ones that are just used for conducting surveillance as opposed to armed for strike packages. Air components that go with that, from a fixed wing to helicopter assets to intelligence units that would need to collect, analyze information to a number of other enablers that we looked at, including Medevac. So we built a bunch of packages and then assessed that at least the 8 to 12,000 number that we came in, this gets to your second part, would be sufficient for not just doing some limited counterterrorism options, including with Afghan forces, but could do some training, advising, and assisting of Afghan National Army forces, Afghan National Police forces, and then the high-end units, the Afghan National Army Commandos, the Afghan National Army Katehas, which are the strike forces, the Afghan National Army Special Forces. So we laid out a range of these packages, and on the 8 to 12 that we came up with, there was a major training, advising, and assisting component of that. And then just briefly to your last point, NATO absolutely has and should play an important role. And in fact, we say this pretty explicitly, that there are a number of countries that have capabilities, especially on the training side, they can do this. British have a long history of doing this kind of training, including in southern Afghanistan, and a number of other countries that have been doing this over the last several years, Germans up the north, Italians in the west part of the country. So that kind of assistance, I think, would be extremely helpful in virtually all the areas that I identified earlier. So if we're going down to those levels, Again, I think the more international support, particularly from NATO countries, the better off Afghanistan will be. Good question again from UCLA.
Great, thank you. Just to wrap up, Seth, what would you recommend to President Obama in forging a relationship with the new president of Afghanistan?
Well, I'd recommend a couple things. One is I think the administration has actually been very careful and cautious in a good way since the elections happened on Saturday. There was a lot of, in 2009, a lot of public comments of corruption, and a lot of it was unhelpful. There were comments about the U.S. supporting specific candidates. I would suggest as we move forward over the next couple of weeks on the election process that the administration stay supportive of the Afghans trying to figure this out. I mean, there may be some areas where the administration can assert itself in, especially if there turn out to be large concerns about ballot box stuffing and fraud. But I think letting the Afghans figure this out is helpful. The other issue is the U.S. can certainly be supportive of whoever this candidate is, whoever wins, in helping encourage a multi-ethnic team. The next question for this the new Afghan president is to build a team to put people into key ministries. And as we've already talked about on this call, filling those spots with effective government officials that come from across Afghanistan's constituencies to try to knit the ethnicities into the government, Tajiks, Uzbeks, Hazaras, and others, I think is quite important. And the third thing from a U.S. public relations standpoint is going to be to work with the new president to sign a bilateral security agreement. This would allow a U.S. presence in Afghanistan for the foreseeable future through, say, 2017, which is missing right now. The current Afghan president, Karzai, has not been willing to sign a security agreement with the United States, despite the fact that Afghans overwhelmingly support a U.S. presence. There was a major Loya Jirga a couple of months ago in the fall in Afghanistan, which supported a continuing U.S. presence. I think that the U.S. president has got to work on signing that bilateral security agreement, but not do it publicly, not publicly try to pressure the president into doing it, as we did with as the U.S. did with Karzai back in the fall, but to do it largely quietly, because again, there's going to be a lot of things that this next president is going to have to do, and I think putting public pressure on them is going to be more unhelpful, and it's going to cause, I think, a future Afghan president to look at his domestic constituency. And just the fourth thing I'd say real briefly is there is, I think there's going to be a need, and I would strongly encourage the president, I've said this to virtually all of his foreign policy team personally, is the need to stay. Afghanistan is a much better society than it was 13 years ago. And human rights is in a much better position. Women's rights are in a much better position today than they were then. I think the investments required now to keep Afghanistan moving in the right direction and to protect U.S. national security interests with terrorist groups operating there are small, but the benefits are enormous. So I would encourage the president to continue to provide limited U.S. forces, as the U.S. does right now in the Philippines and Colombia and other countries, with much less at stake, and to continue to providing basic assistance to issues like health care and education for the Afghan population. Again, the benefits heavily outweigh the costs involved. So that's the line that I'd encourage the U.S. president to consider.
That is a great line, and also to add on to that, to actually, you know, make that case to the American people. I think that's an important component.
Yeah, and if I could just follow up on that real quickly, I mean, that is one thing that I think has not happened recently is a case for staying in Afghanistan made by the White House to the American population. It is the location right now we continue to have the largest number of U.S. combat forces anywhere in the world, and that is forces engaged in combat. We obviously have large numbers of forces in the Korean Peninsula and Japan and a few other places, but they're not engaged in combat. And so making the case to the brave American men and women that are fighting in Afghanistan, the brave American civilians that are risking their lives, making that case to the American population has not, in my view, been adequate and must be done sooner rather than later.
Great. Thank you, Seth Jones, for sharing your insights today for the Council special report that you authored. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to continuing to follow your work at RAND.
Thanks everybody, for participating. And thank you.
Yep, for the terrific questions from the group. Just as a reminder, our last calls of the semester will be on Thursday, April 24th, with Gail Lamond, CFR Senior Fellow for Women in Foreign Policy, and she will talk about global gender gaps. In the meantime, please follow us, our academic initiative, on Twitter at CFR_academic for information on news, CFR resources, and upcoming events. So thank you again to Seth Jones and to all of you for your participation.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.